Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, Episode 4 for 19 January 2011. Bob Frankston. Welcome to the Triangulation. Once again, Leo Laporte here with Mr. Tom Merritt.
Hello there.
Episode 4. I guess we'll get back to, you know, we have taped, I don't know, a dozen episodes. Taped.
We did. We put them right down on.
Yeah, that's how we record them.
Three-quarter inch tape.
And those episodes will appear on the Triangulation feed soon. We've got Waz. We've got a lot of great interviews. And coming up, I'm gonna take a three-week break in a couple of weeks because I'm going to South America. But when I come back, I hope we'll get Captain Crunch on.
Oh, great.
And a lot of interesting people. This is a show where we interview the most interesting people in tech. And it's really just Tom and me getting a chance to talk to people we really, really, really want to talk to. Bob Frankston is somebody I've met before. I ran into him at CES a couple of years running. Again at CES this year. He's a name everybody should know. He wrote probably the single most important program in personal computing, because without it, I don't know if personal computing would be what it is today. He wrote VisiCalc. He and Dan Bricklin created Software Arts, and VisiCalc was the very first spreadsheet program. In 1979, it was written for the Apple II and later ported to other devices. But the idea being that spreadsheets, which Dan took a business class, they were paper. You would have to erase numbers and write them in again. Yeah. They existed. And Dan said, you know, this would be a perfect application for personal computer. At the time, the Apple II was really considered a toy. It became the first killer app, an application you had to have, an application that actually drove sales of computers. Because people would buy an Apple II just so they could run VisiCalc.
It was actually one of the reasons my dad wanted to get a computer.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I want to use the spreadsheet on it, okay?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It made it, it legitimized it. He worked at the successor to VisiCalc, Lotus 1-2-3. He was with Lotus Development, and he developed Lotus Express and started Lotus.com, he says, even though it was before the web in 86 to 1990. Went to Microsoft in 1993. Where he worked in networking, he designed the first routers and made networking accessible to home users. And you can find out more about Bob and his writings at his website, bobfrankston.com. Let me call Bob and get him on the show, because he is a champion of internet freedom. In fact, has something very, I think, very important to say. When we talked at CES, we only had a few minutes. Didn't really have much time to talk to him, so I'm very glad to get him back on for a little bit of a longer interview. Bob Frankston, everybody. Hey, Bob.
Hi there.
It's great to talk to you.
Good to be back.
And I'm glad we have a little more time. We're not so rushed this time.
Okay.
So I just went through your CV a little bit and pointed people to Frankston.com. I don't know if you heard all of that.
No, I wanted to stay pure before the show.
As you are pure,
tabula rasa.
I'm glad to say Bob is completely pure. So basically, I went through your history, which probably anybody who knows anything about personal computing knows about VisiCalc, and probably knows a little bit about the history of VisiCalc. But you know, you've done so much more. In fact, when we talked at CES this year. We started talking a little bit about what you did at Microsoft, and in fact that we can thank you for the fact that internet service providers don't charge each and every user. They only charge per household. How did that come about?
Well, this is long and short. Very simply, I commuted to Microsoft because my wife didn't want to move. What could I do? So I work here at home a lot, and this sort of, I was used to connecting my machines and actually using them. So when there was a meeting to figure out how to get more people online with ISDN, I rapidly...
This was ISDN. This wasn't cable modems or DSL.
This was the days of ISDN, which you considered high speed then.
Right.
And I figured out the problem with ISDN was not the price. Well, the price was an issue. I'll bring that up. But the complexity. So once I figured out you can run a radio frequency signal over the phone wires to connect, it said, well, I can create a home network. And I'd already been playing with this myself. So it was just a minor problem. All I need to remove is anything that made it hard.
Well, wait. When you say over the phone wires, you mean inside the house or you mean...
Inside the house.
Inside the house.
And this is, I think, an important point here, is when people talk about these things, it's very easy to get confused, like broadband over power line.
Right.
Is a big difference between outside the house and inside the house. And the only reason why, you know, I persist the phone line is I need an example of what I call no new wires networking. You know, at some point it became obvious that, you know, wireless, Wi-Fi was going to be an important means.
Right. But this is well before Wi-Fi, absolutely.
Well, a little before, yes. Yeah. And, you know, people who can't run Ethernet. The important thing was that it really didn't matter how you connected. The phone wires just gave an example of what's in every home so that people could easily start.
Right.
So this began your idea of, like, let's use the wires that we have already and figure out how to connect them, eh?
Well, figure out how to connect using whatever wires we have, yeah. This is about in 1995.
Windows 95 era. Actually, pre-Windows 95.
I happened to be in the Windows 95 group at the time.
Okay.
But, it was sort of more a coincidence. I was sort of doing my own thing.
Right.
But it wasn't – I mean, the hard thing to think back then was, why would you want to connect computers?
Who would want something like – especially at Microsoft, because I remember that Bill Gates came to the internet late.
Well, I mean, part of it was they assumed everybody had one computer. They relied on market surveys.
Right.
I just walked in the store and realized anybody buying a computer was buying a replacement at that point.
They were getting rid of the old and bringing in the new.
No, they were bringing in the new.
But not getting rid of the old.
Well, it's too valuable.
Yeah.
I figured people were going to start, and there was this new thing, the web, which gave you a reason for being connected.
Right.
So... But the other part was convincing people that it could be do-it-yourself.
Right.
And even now, because, you know, one of the hard things is it doesn't mean everybody has to go run wires. But it means you're not dependent upon a professional installer. More important, you're not depending on the cable company or the phone company coming in and doing it for you. So you could hire people to do it. But you didn't have to.
Right.
And that's liberating. So you're not dependent upon a provider to do it for you.
But now you've got two computers in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to have internet on both of them.
Yes. So you want to do that and you want to connect to the internet. This was the dial-up days. So the important point there was that you wanted to turn on your machine and you assume you're connected. Now, I'd already worked on one product called Lotus Express, another thing very few people had heard of. What it was an email program that sat on your computer, and instead of dialing up, the problem is a lot of you listening probably don't even remember dial-up.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people going, oh, wow, this is ancient history. It wasn't that long ago. 15 years ago, that's all.
No, it wasn't that long. I remember my first modem. Back in 1966.
Oh, yeah, the 66, okay.
Yes. It was in a wooden box. I can even get it.
Do you have it?
Yes.
Let's see it. Come on, let's see it. I got to see this.
The problem is I don't know if I can find it real time. At some point, I'll just call you up or send you a snip of it.
I would love to see a wooden modem. I remember my first acoustic coupled modem, 300 baud, where you have the phone, you dial the phone, and you hear, and then you go, okay, quick, and you jam it into two rubber cups. But we all remember that.
Yeah. It was early 80s.
Yeah. Well, 60s also.
Yeah.
Same thing, huh?
As a matter of fact, this was a wooden acoustic coupler.
Okay.
That's
where the word modem comes from, is taking digital data and modulating it so that it sounds like something that the phone can carry, and then demodulating it back into data. Modem, modulate, demodulate.
Right. And we had to basically pretend it was a phone call. And... I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but let me just point this out. The phone network was designed to reserve capacity for each phone call.
Right.
Because you had this layer dependency. Every layer had to do just the right thing. So that you had to make, in other words, you couldn't get call quality unless every element in the system was properly designed, was carefully balanced.
The network was only as strong as its weakest link.
Yes, and especially the analog days. It was a miracle you could communicate at all. Everything's tweaked, you know, just right. So when they came to a digital phone network, instead of saying, wait, let's rethink this, they said, let's pretend this is just like the analog phone network, where every element is critical, and the reserve capacity. And, of course, in order to ensure things worked, you had to reserve extra capacity so that you had headroom.
Okay.
So the modem then was able to use the phone wires and would reserve capacity for the call. And that worked fine as long as there were a few modems. Nobody noticed the difference. The problem was...
You're saying that they couldn't use the full bandwidth of the copper?
Oh, of course. You could use... Well, take a look at a copper wire. In 1966, the copper wire carried one phone call. A day, maybe that was a kilobit per day, you know, over the average over a day, or much less.
Right.
Then one day, in about the 1980s, the telephone companies wanted to do interactive TV.
Uh-oh.
Suddenly, that wire can carry a megabit. We called it DSL.
Digital subscriber line.
Which was originated for television services, not for internet, right?
Yes, asynchronous digital subscriber line was for television. So that same physical copper wire can now carry a megabit. But as a phone wire, it still carried one kilobit per day.
To protect
the network. On the average. Well, it was just, it was the phone company. That's all they needed. It was driven by not, the important thing to realize is the capacity of the wire, we talk about it, and the whole broadband initiative. We're talking about the wire's capacity set by a business model. Not by physics.
Right.
And in fact, you can argue we have 100% broadband now. If we just took all those copper wires, lit them up to 25-year-old DSL, we'd be connected everywhere for essentially no additional cost. No $80 billion for fiber. We'd be connected immediately.
Now, if you're listening and you think, well, this is ancient history, keep listening because this is a setup for a call to action. And I just want to say that up front because, so pay attention to what Bob is saying. There will be an assignment. You will have an assignment by the end of the show.
Possibly a little math,
yeah,
but not a lot.
Not a lot. But so it's important that you understand why things are the way they are, I guess.
Yes, and what they could be. So if you look at 25, think of 1987 as a year for DSL. 1 megabit. It might have been a little more, but let's say it's one. And it's not much more now. How fast is your computer then? How big were your disk drives?
Yeah, 90 megahertz, and I would be lucky if I had a gigabyte drive. It's probably more like 500 megabytes.
Gigabyte? No, in 87?
Oh, 100 megabytes?
No, 100. 10 megabytes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Megabytes.
Memory was maybe 512 kilobytes, which is a huge increase over 32 kilobytes from 1980.
Right. Yeah, my IBM PS2 3286 sitting upstairs has a 4 megabyte drive and 512 RAM.
Yes.
And it's an attractive little devil, too.
Isn't it?
Right. And it was probably a 286.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, DSL. So if you look at Moore's Law growth in that time, all those have increased by a factor like million.
Right.
Okay, your home network is a gigabit now. The routers are $50 for a gigabit switch today.
Right.
DSL is not improved.
It's the same.
That. Yes. Now, I call that a criminal violation of Moore's Law.
Why is it the same? Just business model?
Business model. Technology is driven by business model and vice versa. So if you look at, if anybody remembers film, when you develop film for pictures, color film is very complicated to develop.
Right.
Yet it's cheaper than black and white because the business for doing, you develop color techniques and there was no investment in black and white. We see this again and again. And people find a hard time understanding that because they accept the limits that they're told, oh, this DSL has this 1 mile capacity. Well, using the technology of 1987, sure.
But why, Bob, isn't it in their business interest to make it faster and better? Doesn't that wouldn't they make more money that way?
No. Let's say you're a company making milk.
Okay.
You made too much milk. What happens?
Overcapacity. The price plummets.
Yes.
You have to pay your lobbyists for price support.
Supply and demand.
Or the farmers cooperate. on producing less milk.
Right. They dump it down the drain. We've seen it happen.
Yes. So now you've got a business that's basically started in the 1800s, 1830s.
The phone company.
The telegraph company. Okay. Its business was selling telegrams using a very expensive infrastructure.
Right.
It charged a lot for the telegrams because they were very valuable. Remember, in those days, getting news early was considered cheating.
Huge. Yeah. Yeah.
There were laws against it.
Yes, to get information too soon.
Yeah.
Also, there was a book, The Victorian Internet.
Yeah.
Which told of those days. Now, it wasn't really like the internet, but it's a good story. And it was against the law to use code words because you would cheat the telegraph companies out of the rightful income. You laugh as if it's different today.
Yeah, right.
If you look at the FCC regulations, they're still there. If you don't pay for phone call bits, you're cheating the phone companies. I mean, companies have gotten in trouble for bypassing all this by going digital.
Wow.
So things haven't really changed in that sense. But if you take that business model, then they own the infrastructure to sell telegrams, and it's very hard for competition to compete with them. So come the talking telegraph. And I mentioned this at CES. They just renamed telegrams message units.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you didn't need operators, you could place the call yourself, you were still paid the same model. And now it's called minutes. But the problem is, if you make your money selling services, that's fine, as long as your customer can't do it better than you can. And that's what's happened now. And there's one of the essays I point to on my site. If you want to read them, rmf.vc is the name for my short URL. Mm-hmm. And so if you say / assuring scarcity, and if you do a dot TWIT after the end, I'll know it's from the Twit TV show.
Yeah, nice.
Assuring scarcity dot TWIT. So this way I can know.
You've got some pretty sophisticated software in here.
Well, I learned by doing. This is all my own software.
This is cool. What's it written in?
C-sharp,
wow.
But there's a pain to doing it yourself. Everything is broken. My life is in danger. But you learn.
You learn. That really is right there, in a nutshell, my entire story. It's painful, but you learn.
Yeah.
And everything's broken, but you learn.
Yes, so I can see what's possible.
Right.
I mean, this is like home networking. I'm lazy. But it'll put a hell of a lot of work in, make it possible for me to do things and be lazy.
So I love this quote. This is from Amartya Sen. No famine has ever occurred in a democratic country with a free press and regular elections. And then you say, connectivity is the free press and the economic fuel for the 21st century. So we're sitting here with a 20th century telecom regime. In effect, assuring scarcity.
A 19th century.
19th century, dedicated to assuring scarcity and keeping us from what we really deserve, which is
abundance.
Abundance of connectivity.
But if you read the essay, so I quoted a slideshow from a regulatory site, saying the number one threat to the cellular phone business. It's too much capacity.
But that's exactly the opposite of what they're saying. Every carrier is saying we've got a crunch on. We have to raise prices.
Of course. They said they would do this. We're not talking about a secret conspiracy. They explicitly said the plan was to limit capacity so customers can't do service. They have to buy them. And to limit number of bits so the value stays up.
The way I sometimes, you tell me if this is apt or not, is I describe it as they want us to buy bits at retail. We want to buy them at wholesale.
Right. Because we're all independent producers now,
right?
Essentially. And so why wouldn't we get it at wholesale? It's the same whether it's wholesale or retail. They're trying to create an artificial scarcity.
But you're not going far enough.
Okay.
We think of bits like electricity, something we pipe in the house. You know, you get your car, you're jacking the bits. That's the wrong model. That's a bad metaphor. Electricity, you're actually using up the power generated in the hydroelectric dams, burning coal, whatever. Bits are not consumed. They're exchanged. It's like we run out of the letter E.
You can't.
Well, that's interesting. And then you're George Perec, and you have to write a
void.
You
could. I mean, I'm sure in the old days, you know, you get with lead type.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You would worry, do I have enough E's for today? But you know, we're so used to what I call Malthusian scarcity, the zero sum,
right,
limited pi, that we just assume we're going to run out of things.
But if you have too many bits on a network, you do have congestion, you do have packet loss. I mean, those things are true, right?
Well, not, you know, there's another essay. The short is Purpose Versus Discovery, or PVD, if you want the short name. I go into this in more detail. We really have to start thinking differently about sort of how you do things. We used to say, we want one result. And if you spin a roulette wheel and you insist on the number 7, you're going to lose. But if you're flexible, you spin the wheel, you look at a number, what can I do with it? You'll always win. So if you say we need the internet is high speed, and if we don't have high speed, it's nothing. Let's throw it away. You're guaranteed to lose. But remember, the internet started with dial-up use. The web. Let me be now even more specific.
Mm-hmm.
The web started with dial. The internet, I'll get into more, is something more fundamental. The web started out with dial-up use. We were excited. It worked fine. You do not need high speed, say, to do Amazon. It's better with high speed, but not necessary. But because the modems gave people a reason to add capacity, we got used to the speed and we started depending on it. It was not fundamental. So if you could take advantage of the resources available, rather than saying, you know, nothing can happen unless you give me everything I want, you know, you can have abundance. As the, you know, demand, you, in other words, the internet started out, we discovered email worked. That was fine. As we got more capacity, we discovered we can do more. So when you talk about congestion, mm-hmm. that's like running out of CPUs, running, you know, we've always managed to find so many applications we can use with what's available that's not the problem. Yes, there's some things that won't work well. But if you can take advantage of the opportunities, you discover there's so many opportunities that you know, okay, it's like you're driving somewhere.
I'll give you an example. Twitter. Twitter is 140 characters per message.
Sure.
It frankly is a very economical way to communicate.
You can run it on Gopher.
Yeah.
Yes. You can run on barbed wire.
Yeah.
Barbed wire. I love it.
It's a great, it's a medium. Right. And so if you say you want to go on vacation, and you just want to go on vacation.
Yeah.
If you insist on going to the one place everybody's going, it's going to be expensive and crowded. But if you're flexible, you just want some time off, it would cost, it could be very inexpensive and won't be crowded.
Is there a little bit of living within your means to this sort of argument? Like,
I think that's the wrong thing. But living within your means makes us, okay, I'm stuck, I can't do this. Think of an abundance of choices.
Mm-hmm.
Any number of things you can do that are all interesting. The more flexible you are in what you accept, and that's really what drives Moore's Law. So, I mean, I became fascinated by this. Another essay I have is Beyond Limits, where this goes back to the learning curve back in college. And I realized that the learning curve is bogus. It means you're throwing away all the interesting information to get this nice curve. But if you look, and this is what I wrote in 1997, if you look at how Intel builds chips, every time they would use a different process, they would change die size, they would use better instructions, they would go, you know, each time they increased speed, they were using different methods. Just like modems, each time you increase in speed, you use a different method. Modem actually is a good example because, you know, you went to the dial-up modems. I remember when 10 characters per second was fast. And that particular technology can go up to 30 characters per second. It hit a wall. But then people said, well, instead of just whistling like we did in those days, we can do more complex math. You go faster. And then sometimes in the 1990s, somebody looked at the phone network and realized that inside the phone network, the digital network, it converted your analog signal on the copper wire to a digital signal. And a codec, coded decoder, is just like a modem, basically. And it took your analog voice, converted to a digital signal on the phone line. And that was 56 kilobit was the limit of the U.S. phone system. What they realized is that if you reverse model, in other words, instead of pretending you're just whistling, if you knew the rules for that codec, you could go at the full 56 kilobits. And it was a digital signal across the network. And you had this copper wire with huge capacity locally, but you had access to the copper wire, not the provisioned version of it. You can have 56 kilobit dial-up, which is just as fast as ISDN channel.
So if I get it right, a little bit of what you're saying is not you have to give up something, but let's figure out what all we can do with what we've got before we feel like we have to move on.
Well, you've got so many possibilities. Instead of being rigid, explore the possibilities. This is how evolution works, too. You don't know what, in other words, you don't know even what to ask for because you don't know the future, but there's so many opportunities that you'll find and this is the counterintuitive. People think they're solving problems when more often they're finding problems that match the solutions they already have.
Mm-hmm. I think from the consumer side, this sounds a little off because they don't get to choose. Right? They're stuck with, hey, you know what? I've got DSL or Comcast, and I want to be able to play World of Warcraft, stream a Hulu video, and make Skype calls to my grandma. And the only way I could do that is with the faster connection from Comcast. So how do we solve that problem so that they actually can take advantage of what you're talking about?
Oh, okay. Actually, just one example before that's not computer. Suburbs rose once you had the highways. We didn't build the highways to reach the suburbs. Mm-hmm. We created the suburbs by having the highways. So it's a backwards thing. So picture this is now 1980, and we want to do voice over IP. Meant 83 maybe for IP. You couldn't. Now, we had a choice. We could have built an IP, you know, phone net into IP and charge you extra for this fancy internet. Fortunately, we didn't. Because you already had the phone network. Turns out, roll ahead to once we had the web, the internet had increased capacity for the web to the point that voice over IP started to work. So we didn't make it a requirement. We discovered it was a possibility. Now, the anomaly here is we've gotten used to Skype and all these high-speed services. So we're making them a requirement. Mm. Fortunately, actually, we can meet that requirement. But we have to be very careful in understanding that the more we make it a requirement, sort of the more limited our choices are. So it's having these requirements that limits our choice. Hmm. But as I said, the counterintuitive thing is we can actually meet that. So let's say you're in a small city that had a copper wires running everywhere. Well, if you took over those copper wires and said the city owns them, you could run them as DSL without having to pay a monthly fee for service and without getting the provision by a carrier to 25-year-old rules.
You just say this new rules. New rules. Well, we got the copper. New rules.
And it's copper. Remember, I didn't say pairs.
And you didn't say fiber. You just said copper.
Well, you can start with copper. And fiber is cheap to put in once you see the value. The problem now is that we're making fiber expensive because we're getting it from a company, for the company store. How many of you remember the song 16 Tons?
Oh, my soul to the company store.
Right. Because you can never own it. You can never get out of debt.
Right, right.
So when do you finish paying for the copper or the fiber and become an owner?
Never.
Right. Now,
see, I always thought, in fact, I've heard that I've talked to my friend Dane Jesper. We're going to get on the show. He's at ISP here in the Bay Area. It's an independent internet service provider. In fact, he was the former president of CISPA, the California Independent Internet Service Providers. And he said the real problem is that these companies want to amortize the cost of copper and have no incentive to go to fiber. You're saying, I think it's true, they've long ago amortized the cost of copper. That doesn't have anything to do with it.
The reason they want to go to fiber is pure business model. They have to share the copper, number one.
So they do want to get rid of the copper.
Yes, they do want to get rid of the copper. And think about it. Let's say that you put $80 billion in a new fiber plant.
Something like, I don't know, what Verizon's put into Fios, but I'm sure it's comparable.
They stopped doing it. It's not full. They didn't spend the full $80 billion.
Right.
But now you say, okay, If we don't need the fiber, we're going to give it back to the city. And there's actually legal precedent for the city taking it back. Remember, we gave them right of way.
It's right away, yeah.
Okay, now what if the copper's available? And with technology, you could be running it a couple of megabits. For, as a city resource, like the streets, there's no ongoing charge. We've already paid for it. That means that, that takes the value of Fios and goes from $50 billion to $0
billion. Why is that? Because we should set, cause don't people want the extra bandwidth of the Fios?
Well, they don't get much of that extra bandwidth. How, you know, what? How many much do people typically get on Fios and use?
Well, it's true. A solid megabit or two, if everybody got a solid megabit or two, it'd be much more useful, in fact, than people realize. I think you're right on that, Bob.
And it's gotten worse. And this is where, you see, this is why I'm so fascinated by evolution. Another reason has to do with the gaming industry. Not the Las Vegas kind. I'm talking about the video games. That video capture board, that's not a capture, I mean the video board for games.
Graphics card, yeah.
Graphics card can now do what the DSL people in 87 could only dream of in terms of compression and decompression.
Oh.
Well, that's essentially what OnLive is banking on.
Yeah, you're saying that copper is sufficient, given our incredible hardware capabilities, to do what fiber's doing.
I'm not saying it's a complete replacement for fiber, because when we want to go to gigabits cheap, fiber's lower energy, the real good reasons for going to fiber.
Okay. Do you mean to say, though, that these companies are vacating their fiber installations, I mean their copper installations, they want to go to fiber, and they're leaving these copper installations available to us? I mean, could we do this?
That's an interesting question. The answer, short answer is yes. There have been, you know, people have said Verizon's chopping the copper. They did, when I put my Fios in, they did want to cut my copper wires, but I had too many wires and they got scared.
They didn't know which to cut.
But they've been denying this while doing it.
Right.
So, yes, this is an issue because they see the problem. But the story, you see, if you look at these stories, they don't make sense. They say copper is so expensive. Well, then they should be giving everybody a Fios connection if the copper is so expensive. Instead, they leave the copper there until you subscribe to Fios. So the story is not a consistent story.
Right.
But it goes back to the fundamental problem that the traditional telecommunications industry faces. You can't make money selling services. You can't make money selling bits.
Right.
And fortunately, there is a solution to that.
By the way, I want to point out that's exactly the cable company's problem as well. It's not just telco.
Oh, well, that's another story. That's why Comcast bought NBC Universal.
Absolutely.
I can now say bought instead of proposed to buy.
Right. Because that's a business.
Yes.
Bits is not a business.
Exactly. You make the money using the network. Mm-hmm. And this is J.P. Rangaswamy, who was at BT, pointed out. You make the money using the network, not by owning the network.
Well, when you put it that way, it makes me think that the issue isn't that Comcast is now in charge of the ISP and the broadcast and the cable all at once. The issue now is that we're actually allowing these companies like AT&T and Verizon and Comcast to try to make money off of that networking when there really shouldn't be a business there. Is that what
let me be very clear. There's an inherent conflict of interest in owning the transport and the content business. I use the analogy, picture Stagecoach Company that owned roads. They built Stagecoach roads. A hokey analogy, but, you know, you put up with what you can get. and the government said, you know, you got to allow cars.
I'll give you a better one. I'll give you a better one, a historical precedent. The movie companies owning the movie theaters.
Sure.
Yes. And in the 1970s, they had to divest themselves of the theaters.
Because it was clearly a conflict of interest.
Yes. But the Stagecoach Company example, again, hokey though it is, they could allow cars on the roads to share it with the horses. But, of course, they're not going to pave the roads. That would give the cars an unfair advantage.
Right.
So you don't have the incentive to improve it, just as you don't have the incentive to improve DSL. Instead, you tell people stories they believe, that there's a magical limit. And they abuse Claude Shannon to no end by treating the mathematical model as the same as the real-world physics model.
Shannon's law refers to the carrying capacity
Shannon's law is a mathematical model. It doesn't tell you what the carrier capacity actually is. That depends on how the physics and cleverness. Okay, let me give you an example. So the stagecoach example we had. Another example is here's a good question for you. How many bits does it take to represent the Encyclopedia Britannica?
I don't know. It's probably let's say it's less than a terabyte, probably.
Okay. Well, it actually fit on a CD.
Yeah, it's probably 700. I was going to say 100 megabytes.
Okay,
there you go. Okay, lower gigabyte, whatever. How much can you compress it down to?
Well, it's text.
You zip it.
Yeah. Quite a bit.
Well, it has pictures, too, and all that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't half that.
10 digits.
10 digits?
Yes.
You can represent the whole encyclopedia in 10, you mean 10 bytes?
Yeah, actually less than 10 bytes. If it's digits.
What? No, you can't.
Yes, you can.
How?
ISBN number.
Oh, you. Yeah, but that's a reference. That's a reference, not the actual data.
So is A, B, C, D, E, the alphabet, the words, the references. We just decide what dictionary to use, and the ISBN table is a common dictionary.
Okay, but somewhere the data has to exist somewhere.
Of course. But the point is, you have to change how you think of it. I'm not cheating, because any compression scheme, you have to agree on the meaning of the words in the dictionary.
But if I zip a file and I uncompress it, I have the data. If I have an ISBN, how do I get the data out of that ISBN? I have to have the data to refer to?
It's just a reference. You need the original.
You need the dictionary.
Right.
And it might be a bookstore or something. So I actually did this in practice. It's not theory.
Okay.
My mother wanted to get a toy to my nephew who's across the country. I said, fine, I'll have it there this afternoon. So I returned the toy to Radio Shack, gave my brother the number, and he went to Radio Shack and bought the same toy. it's an example of how we sort of...
What's the bandwidth of that transaction?
Right, yeah, it's very low bandwidth.
No, and this is my point. If you restate the problem...
Right.
You can come up with a kind of solution that doesn't... In other words, I have, in a sense, if I constrain the solution too much, I've got a problem. But you get the Moore's law effects when you don't constrain the solution, when you allow you to solve a different problem. So if Intel had insisted that it was making Unix processors, remember the days, by the way, the largest Unix company in the early 1980s was?
Bell, right? No, who?
Microsoft.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They had Xenix. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so if Intel said, no, you can't run Windows, this is a Xenix machine, we would have stopped this growth process.
Right.
Instead, sorry.
It was just general purpose. It's a general purpose processor.
Well, but it's more the decoupling. We didn't tie the solution to say this is the way you had to do it. We allowed people to innovate with the CPU any way they wanted to.
Right.
And so when we stopped running, when we were unable to make the CPUs any faster, this is in 97, I said, the obvious thing we're going to do is go to multiple CPUs.
Double them up, yep.
But that doesn't make the CPU faster. It changes different problems for which the speed makes sense.
Right.
So this is where you get most. If you step far enough back, you can say it's faster. But if you get at the clock, it's not. Because that measures one CPU.
Right.
So it's this changing of the rules and measures that's important. So if you're buying a service from a service provider, you don't have the flexibility. If you get DSL line, it's DSL, you don't have the flexibility. But if your community owns the copper wire, it has the flexibility. You can redefine it. So in the 1990s, the home of the future had this thing called structured wiring. I call it structural because it's so thick it holds up the house.
Yeah, right.
It had fiber coax future proofed. Who thought this thin Ethernet would be going at a gigabit?
Well, I have to say, I remember spending a lot of time on my radio show telling people, well, I got to, when they said, well, I'm building a house, what should I put in there? And I said that kind of answer. And then Wi-Fi came up. And it was like, oh, gee, I'm sorry you built all that stuff into the wall because you're all wireless now.
But the wires are still used. I mean, you can use both. The point is the technology went with copper.
Right.
I still string Ethernet all over my house
because
it's more reliable than Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
I do, and I use flat Ethernet, which is nice. You can run under the carpets. All the things you weren't supposed to do, turns out there's a reason to have them. The strange part is Fios now insists on using ancient RG6 coax because they can poach it from Comcast.
Which is a good example of using the wires that exist.
Yes, except now when you need a new set-top box, they got to roll the truck instead of saying run your own damn
wire. So let me see if I can synopsize this in a way that we can move to the next stage of the conversation. So basically, people are giving you the answer to the question instead of leaving the question open-ended and letting the answers happen. So we have copper, we have fiber. For business reasons, the phone companies, the cable companies are doing what they want to do. Makes sense from their point of view. But from the point of view of us as end users, maybe the perfect is the enemy of the good, and we should be happy with copper that we can own.
Well, let me be specific. First, these are zombie companies. The business model doesn't make sense. It's not going to survive.
Yeah, I've wondered that because I've talked to people like at Cablevision and so forth, and they keep saying, we have to sell premium services. We can't sell you bits.
Well, yes. So the answer is, let's help them.
Okay.
The problem right now is you need a different model for the bits, which uses shorthand for the what we do with the physical infrastructure, and for the services. Those are two different business models. So we don't fund the road by paying a toll every time we leave the driveway. Because the value of the road is not in individual bricks or piece of pavement. The value comes to the road system as a whole. So we pay for the system as a whole, as infrastructure. Now, you don't have tolls on Main Street.
No.
Which, right?
That's socialism.
No, it's capitalism. Capitalism. Remember, the current FCC was created in 1934 during the Great Depression, where we didn't trust markets. So the government is managing the market in a socialist way.
Mm-hmm.
Both extreme socialism and capitalism are problems. But for the people who think the telephone system is a capitalist system, no, it's not.
Thank you.
It's a government-managed system.
Yeah, and it always has been.
Well, you could argue the telegraph days.
Okay, maybe not, but yeah.
When Congress turned down Sam Morse, other countries... The government built them. But so I'm a capitalist. I believe in effective markets. But we need effective markets at work. So the market that works here is to decouple the silo and say the physical infrastructure is owned as a commons. You pay for it as a whole, like we pay for the streets. That puts incentives in line. Remember, you own the network in your home. You don't pay anything per month to use the network in your home. Not only that, it went from modem speeds with modem. What is a modem? It 20 years ago, $200 went, $2,400. Today, you run a gigabit and you pay $50 for a switch.
Right.
That's like a million to one price performance improvement because you're an owner and you drove the market. And we normalize the bits so we can mix and match. And if we want to really be technical, you don't even have a network in your home. You've got copper and radios you use to exchange bits. And the rule on the wire is, as long as you don't destroy the other guy's packets, do what you want. And, so it would be good to take, the switch isolates segments. But, if you run a 10 megabit Ethernet link, that's going to get in the way of your gigabit usage. Actually, if you really want to push technology, there are all sorts of sidetracks, but we can make even better use of the copper than we do now with current signal processing. But that's another side story.
So let's get a call to action here. Do you think that this is even feasible, that we can go to our local governments and say, hey, local government, acquire the copper. Help the companies out here and acquire the copper. Is that even feasible, Bob?
Not that directly.
Okay.
But if you go the right way, it's feasible. But I want to be very clear. The reason I'm favoring copper, fiber is nice, and I do think we should go to fiber. It's a financing problem. If you start with the copper, there's essentially no cost.
Because it exists. It's been amortized. The city really owns all the rights of way. They could just take it back.
Your cost would only be management. And I think you're saying management is pretty low. Almost nothing.
I can make that software.
It's a lot cheaper than managing a street and keeping the potholes.
There are a lot of side things. I was just at a talk on the so-called smart grid. Which is another way of saying that the not gratuitously dumb grid. You know, and it can't zoom infrastructure, so you're not paying your power lines for making phone calls to get meter data back, which is absurd. So there are a lot of these things that would use the infrastructure. So one thing actually to understand is I'm not talking about the web. That's just one minor application. You know, I'm talking about, like, this is my lights, one of my light switches. Got to get in the camera. Where's the camera?
Here you go.
Okay. Now, it's just, it has a wire. I have wireless ones, but it turns out the problem with wireless devices, you lose them.
They're not attached.
But this light switch uses electronic signaling. So the light just went off, the light on, to communicate. Now, this doesn't use internet protocols, but, you know, it should. They should use common protocols to connect devices. And one consequence of this is you get hardware people designing light switches, which is not a good idea. It's basic infrastructure. Why, when a neighbor of mine's house had a fire, he had to rely on somebody across the street seeing flames coming out? Why was there a smart fire detector that just reported it over the common infrastructure?
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing you have to do is understand we're talking about infrastructure, not web access to something out there. This is communicating among the city. So there's a lot of value there. The other thing in financing is just fiber is cheap and will become cheaper very quickly once it's outside the control of the phone company, just like your home network is. So it's not – so you want to start with the copper, go to the fiber. Now, the cities are not going to understand that message for various reasons.
I can tell you that. I've been on the technology committee at Petaluma and understand that. I don't think
– So, but there are cities –
But we had a lot of conversations about how Comcast was screwing us.
Yes.
So there is some awareness that there's a problem.
Oh, exactly. But there's no articulate awareness.
Right.
That's the difference. And I'm trying to give you some articulate awareness. That if you understand that why do we use the model for the wires as if we're selling content, it should be more like the streets. So that's one. So there is the understanding that comes first. But instead of doing the city, what about taking an apartment house?
Okay. That's easier. Yeah.
And say, we and our condo people, which would aggregate our purchase and buy the connectivity as a
whole. I live in a cul-de-sac. There's probably 10 homes there. I could go to everybody in my cul-de-sac, say, hey, let's do our own internet.
Yes. Our own, we'll aggregate our purchasing.
Right.
And then you could. And this,
now, who do I go to get that?
Yeah, who do you connect to?
The phone company?
Well, this is, for now, you're in a mixed world. Just like your home network at some point falls off the cliff into telephone land.
Right.
At some point, you'll still have to pay for passage. But that can grow arbitrarily large. You know, if your other neighbors see this, you start increase aggregating your purchasing.
Like a snowball.
Right.
Yes. So you start locally and you get these huge ratios because if you've got 10 people sharing 10 wires, again, if there's a limited capacity, putting aside the streaming thing for now, each one gets 10 times the capacity for web browsing.
And then you've got a bunch of excess processor and storage capacity. With a distributed network, you can turn your neighborhood into a CDN.
Seriously. Well, we have to be very careful about this. CDN, by the way, is Content Delivery Network for those
Like Akamai or something, yeah.
Like Akamai. And the problem is the cable companies think that's the purpose of the internet. No, it's something we do with it.
No, but I'm just thinking you start trading your passage rights.
It becomes great. Because, yes, the thing is, a couple of terabyte drives.
Well, didn't we try this with mesh? Wasn't this the idea of mesh networking?
Well, the answer is, yeah, but. Everything is going to be meshed rather than the hierarchical system. But there are a lot of agendas, and it was more the poor folk getting together to say, let's use our thin pipes to interconnect.
Right.
Turns out, you know, one thing when MSN first started, they backhauled all the traffic over fiber to Redmond. There's so much capacity, it didn't matter. So meshing is good for resilience, for huge capacity, but we're not used to how big these numbers are. So even if you backhauled, look at OnLive, you mentioned the gaming thing first. You know, you've got so much capacity in this that we could, you know, there's a contradiction. If OnLive works, why are we arguing about scarcity?
Right.
So I think that we're so used to the, you know, smaller numbers. But the important point I want to get back to is the number one is understanding. Even if you can't do it now, the understanding works at two levels. One, you build up an understanding. And remember, we have like 30,000 cities in the U.S. Some cities will, and there are places where you've got a critical mass of geeks who said, let's do this for ourselves, especially housing developments. If a housing developer is putting it in, he can make connectivity fundamental. And so that's one means. With understanding, we start to see these opportunities. We start to see examples.
Is there a limited window of opportunity here, or is this...
No. It's like, when do you fail to graduate from high school?
Never.
When you stop trying.
When you die, yeah.
When you give up.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's no limited opportunity. And, the it's as we understand it, you know, you can go, you know, you can always pass a law saying... Can you imagine a law saying you had to register your shirt color because if two people in the room had the same shirt, it'd be confusion? That's called spectrum allocation.
Yeah. Right. Right.
You know, so we're capable of doing really stupid things. And
never,
by the way,
undersell the ability to do something really dumb.
Yeah,
with the FCC. This is kind of interesting, and this is how this conversation first came up with Bob. Was he said the net neutrality conversation is the wrong? It's completely the wrong conversation to have. It assumes scarcity, I guess.
Yes, it assumes we have to share the sliver of capacity we get on the side of the telecom world. It doesn't acknowledge the internet as a fundamental concept.
What is the answer to the rhetoric that I hear a lot from listeners as well as legislators that these guys paid to run these wires, this is their business, and we shouldn't have the government involved in it? And so when you say, hey, the government takes over the copper and runs it, it's socialism. That's against free market.
Oh, there are a lot of answers to that.
Yeah.
I call it the stole it fair and square argument.
Stole it fair and square.
Yes.
Should a city use eminent domain and take this copper?
How do you think they ripped got the rights away from us?
That's true. Those rights of way came from the landholders.
And abandoned the copper, so it's not eminent domain as much as they let it lie fallow.
Right.
And there was a precedent apparently for the New York Central Railroad. They wanted to abandon tracks, and the state said, "No, you can't sell the metal. You've got to give that back to us."
So let's start. But I think that's possible. But let's start at a smaller scale. We can make this snowball start with a little pebble. So I'm in a cul-de-sac. I want to do this. I want to organize my neighbors. What do I do? Do I buy a T1 line?
T1?
OC3?
I found T1 funny because some people still think that it's a big number.
I know, 1.4 megabits. It's nothing.
Yeah, it's like the smallest DSL connection you can buy, practically.
What do I do?
This is where, there are people who know how to negotiate for, you know, buying shared capacity.
Okay.
So this is where, I don't want to give you the technical expert, but basically you can find people who know how to sort of, buy the pipes.
Seems like that would be a good business.
Oh, there are a lot of businesses here. So let me...
You could be a carpetbagger that goes from town to town and says, I'll negotiate with you. With the phone company on your behalf.
Well, let me go ahead first, and then I want to backfill to some other answer is...
Well, we're running a little bit out of time, so I do want...
Okay, so...
I hate to do this to you every time you're on, Bob.
Well, we can continue
to
this.
To be continued, but go ahead.
Okay, so how many minutes so I know which wrap-up to give?
5 minutes, if we can do.
Okay, 5 minutes. So, there are companies that used to run fiber in the cities. Those are all bought up by the phone companies. Those skills now are what ISP should be doing. So to take your small ISP, who's just caught in the middle, reselling, those are the companies that have the skills to say, we will now change our business model. We will become more like Geek Squad for connectivity.
This is why we're going to get Dane Jasper in here.
Yeah, right.
And talk about maybe SonicNet could do this here. You know, that's who they are.
And there are thousands of people who have these skills.
Yeah.
The skills are there. But there's another thing I want to bring up for you to think about. What are you doing with these wires? Why, let's say you have a house. You're putting in a lamp. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, why do you have to run a wire from a lamp to a switch just to get the control signal? That's like running wires from each PC to, you know, sort of the source. Well, or some online. In other words, you share a network. Well, the control information for controlling your lights in your house is just bits. Those should be on the network.
Sure.
Your HVAC control should be on your network. Your fire alarm should be on the network. Sure. All of these should be. So once you see that this is not just the web, that this is fundamental infrastructure.
Is it as reliable as?
More reliable.
More reliable.
Because if you can have multiple paths. This is where mission comes in. You know, so you can now, if you do a bad design, you can, of course, make it worse.
Right.
But if you do a good design, then you have redundant paths. And you also, this is where the whole concept of best efforts. And if you read my, one of these UAC is short for Understanding Ambient Connectivity. I go explain more about best efforts. You learn how to design things that are resilient. So let's say a thermostat wire broke. Well, the furnace is not going to go burn your house down. It'll going to have to go into some fail-safe mode. And we understand how to do that.
Right.
So
it's
so,
funny, Bob, because you're a software designer. You see everything as software, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, right.
Well, yes. And that's the beauty of it, because everything is software. Now, what is hardware but frozen software? You look inside the chips. You know, that's all. You say, there's no sharp distinction between software and hardware.
Yeah.
You know, so... but the point is, by making converting things into software networking, we gain huge flexibility, huge cost savings. So I actually did run a new lamp. Just drop the wire to the power and just program the switch to turn the lamp on. And
so maybe instead of starting in my cul-de-sac, I should start in my house.
Yes, starting a house, making more use.
Or business.
Or business.
Right now is I'm a software guy.
Yeah.
So I have to put up with what I can buy off the shelf. So I have to buy this, find the camera.
Box, yeah.
Which is a major improvement over the old X10.
But it's still not IP.
And the protocols, let's say, the less said about them, the better.
Yeah.
But they often work.
they often work.
Actually, no, they usually work. It's a lot better than in the days of X10. I did want my family to know that other houses light switch work.
No, honey, that's the way all houses are.
But luckily, my wife is very tolerant. But my kids didn't know any better.
Right. They just grew up thinking lights don't always come on.
I want to send people to frankston.com, and this is a good place to start. The fundamental right to be connected, the right to communicate.
So there's a lot more to talk about. Let me throw in one last thing to think about.
Yep.
The U.S. First Amendment. Anybody remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was compromised in the 1920s to form the Federal Radio Commission that said we can license the ownership of transmitters. That was then said, we can sell your right to speak between you and your neighbor to a third company far away called a phone company. Because that was the only way they could think of doing it in the 1920s. That violation of the First Amendment cannot be tolerated by the government giving away a right now that we know it's not necessary and creates scarcity. So with all your lawyers out there, you know, now I don't trust the Supreme Court, in many ways, but there's a very simple First Amendment argument that you should have the right to communicate and that the FCC policies have created scarcity and created winners or losers for no reason other than they looked at the clock and it said 1830.
Yeah. A really good point. Really good point. And one we'll end with. Yep.
Yeah, I just want to say, this is the only stuff, I mean, the thing you have to remember, it took years for me to, I mean, I've been at this for nearly, scary, half a century. So I understand that what seems obvious to me is not at all obvious. So I realize that the best I could do now is make people think, maybe something can be different.
Yeah, these are very thorny things. I think you've done a great job of explaining it, but I think also it's hard to get your head wrapped around.
Yeah.
The good news is, and Tom was talking about this, he went to your site last night, he couldn't stop reading. The good news is frankston.com has all this stuff. Would it be the first article, the right to be connected? Would that be the place to start?
Well, that's more of a thing. I mean, one of my recent ones, the keyword is demystify.
Okay.
Explains why you don't do network providers. So that for the geeks, that goes into really a lot of why you don't do network providers. And if you want to understand another way to think about connectivity, that's the UAC or Understanding Ambient Connectivity.
Okay.
But understanding you have a right to communicate Yeah, I can explain it, but if you accept the idea, I don't have, you know.
I think we can all accept that we have a right to communicate.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's so you know, those go into more technical details to understand. If you want to be entertained, you can see my, and you're really geeky, you can see my CS211 debrief, where I start to explore some other areas in which you apply the same thinking. But ultimately, the internet should disappear into the basic concept of how do we do best efforts connectivity. And today's internet is simply the training wheels for what's possible.
Once everything's connected, it becomes also becomes software. And when it all becomes software with distributed processing, the sky's the limit.
But I hate to close on a negative. Remember that there are countervailing forces.
Oh, yeah. We know that. Mostly economic, right?
No. Malware and mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the real problem.
Yes. So we're not going to this asymptote, but we are improving in various dimensions. We just can't predict how because we don't know what else is going on.
Very good. What a great conversation, and just the tip of the iceberg. But Bob, you've written a lot on this, and
yeah, if you want more, I highly recommend Frankston.com. Demystifying Networking is the one I started reading last night just to get a flavor of like what you're thinking about, and I ended up reading the whole thing. I just got sucked in. It's really good.
Okay, thank you.
Send it to your Kindle. There's PDF versions. You can read it.
Yes, and for typography, I do. For a lot of the essays have a PDF version, so if you print it, that's more readable.
Yep. Bob, we'll just have you back, okay?
But, okay, well, good talking.
We'll call this part one.
This is part one. There's a manifesto, though, which is let's start taking back the internet.
Let's take back our physical infrastructure.
Take back the infrastructure.
Because the key thing is, and this is something I got from Andy Lippman, MIT, networking is something we do. We don't need it to be done for us.
Oh, I love that.
Brilliant.
I love that. And IP everywhere.
Yes, I discovered later what is really saying that, but we'll ignore the pun.
Thank you for acknowledging
Bob.
It.
Okay, great to talk to you, Bob Frankston. We'll talk again very soon. Great talking to you, Bob. Thanks, Bob.
Bye.
Take care. I always feel like when I talk to Bob that we're just scratching the surface.
Right. It's he definitely, and this is why I recommend going and reading.
You got to read it.
Because it gives you the time to sort of absorb what he's saying and realize, wrap your head around all of the implications of what he's talking about.
Right. Very, I think, important, frankly. But the thing that, and I think he started off this way, is he's very out of the box. You really have to kind of let go of your preconceived notions.
Yeah.
And see things differently, which is why that ISBN trick, I mean, it looked like a trick.
Yeah.
But it's important because it is kind of reframe the problem.
Yeah, the key is not to take it as, and so all we need to do is have numbers for everything, and that's he's just saying there's a different way to go about everything,
right.
and that means there's a different way than the ISBN trick, but you just got to look for it. It's the cleverness that he was talking about.
Yeah.
That's key.
And I love it because it does really celebrate our intelligence. This is episode 4 of a show that we'll be continuing, I think, because it's so much fun to do. It's really our chance to talk to the people we always wanted to talk to. Triangulation. We will do this every Wednesday when I'm here and Tom's here at 4, because we have to both be here for it, at 4 p.m.
Otherwise, it's just parallel lines.
Yeah, going off into the distance.
Yeah.
at twit.tv/TRI, you can subscribe. The show is now, I think, as you, if you're watching live, is now, will soon be available to subscribe to, and we have our first 4 episodes in the can. And you can also watch us do this, as I said, every Wednesday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, at live.twit.tv.